This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not advice. Outside the United States, it's for investment professional use only.
Every year you're the CEO, you'll have fewer and fewer people wanting to tell you what's actually happening
right.
and what's really going on. And you need to build different ears yeah. and listening skills.
Welcome back to The Angle from T. Rowe Price, a podcast for curious investors. I'm Eric Vial, Head of Global Investments and Chief Investment Officer here at T. Rowe Price Associates. In this episode, I'm excited to sit down with Jane Fraser, Chief Executive Officer of Citi, one of the world's largest and most global banks. Jane became CEO in March of 2021 and has helped modernize the bank for the digital age. Jane, thank you so much for being on The Angle. It's great to have you.
Oh, I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's really exciting to spend some time with you. Citigroup's a stock that I covered as an analyst, but it was many years ago, and it's fun to reconnect with the company and the story. You've done an amazing job.
It's a new city.
It's a new city. Well said. Maybe let's kind of start there. So, Citi's vision's to be the preeminent banking partner for institutions with cross-border needs. And, one of the things that strikes me is that we're at a little bit of a point now where it seems like we're challenging the idea of globalization. And how do you think about that as you're setting the strategy for Citi?
Yeah, at the moment, if anything, it's making the strategy even more relevant because globalization isn't dead, but it's really changed and it's changing. And we saw that with COVID. We saw it with the war in Ukraine, where that had big ramifications for food and energy supply chains around the world. Like all the flows were moving. Thinking about defense started changing, financial flows changed. Then, of course, all of the AI revolution and all of the needs there changed. Energy again, change financial flows, change technology flows, geopolitics, change technology flow, all of these different things. Tariffs, again, as the US has shifted from the great global coordinator to now more of one of national self-interest, that's put another change through. And so for companies and individuals that need to tap into markets around the world, the need to have one single player that they can call upon that understands what's happening on the ground in incredible depth and sophistication of it, and familiarity, and be able to move things around seamlessly. That has been really, really invaluable. And history matters around the world still. So having, running a bank that's 200 or plus years old, but in many geographies over a century, that actually means we've helped them through the good, bad, and ugly. And so as things change, they come back to Citi because they know that we'll be there, able to innovate and help them adapt.
Yeah, that's amazing. That institutional partnership is something that's hard to replicate, if not impossible, when you've had that kind of experience.
Yeah, I mean, China's been 123 years. We're older than the Bank of China.
Yeah.
India's the same number of years. So that history, particularly in Asia, is very helpful right now because there's just a relationship and trust mm-hmm. that transcends politics.
One of the things that you've done is make a bit of a pivot from your strategy, where you also had a lot of local consumer banks in these different regions, started to pull back from that and really focus on these institutional relationships. Maybe talk a little bit about the decision to do that and what you had to give up, if anything, as part of it.
Yep. For me, it started with what was happening in the world, particularly in financial services, that in the local businesses, you needed tremendous local scale. Mm-hmm. There weren't the same synergies in businesses that were more locally defined. So credit cards, branch banking, onshore wealth, SME, very local and heavily locally regulated. Very few synergies globally.
Right.
Whereas pre the great financial crisis, there were more. Today, no.
Yeah.
But for those local businesses, for me, it became very clear that we should focus the bank on the global businesses that could be run off global platforms,
right.
exit the local, and then really double down on where we're quite a unique bank. There are very, very few banks in the world. I can't even name more than four or five that operate in that sort of multi-jurisdictional way that we do, it's a much needed capability. So it's the bold or the brave comes in saying, okay, we're going to exit a lot of businesses that were historically what Citi was iconic right. and known for globally. And instead, we're going to double down on the ones where we're unique, that have interdependencies and linkages between them, and that we are going to be the disruptor again.
That's great. I definitely want to get into being the disruptor because I would tell you in 20, you know, back when I was covering this stock a decade or so ago, we wouldn't have associated Citigroup and disruptor in the same sentence. So excited to jump into that. Before we get into that, just with that global perspective that you have, you know, what are you hearing from, you know, customers right now? We just had a soft jobs report. It feels like things are, you know, slowing down a little bit of hesitation to invest either in people or in CapEx right now.
I think, well, first of all, the good news now is that there is more clarity. I mean, I think the piece that's been the most difficult the last 3-4 months has been we knew the direction, but we didn't know magnitude, and in tariffs that's meaningful. We didn't have clarity yet on the tax situation. The deregulation was an important promise, but not clear where it's going. Now there is a lot more clarity. With clarity, companies can act. And we're not all the way there yet, but I think there's a much more sense of what do we need to deal with. And it's impressive if you think how resilient and adaptable multinational corporations and the American entrepreneur is today. Yep. Had to be from COVID and a whole range, you know, technological advance, wars, goodness knows what else we've been dealing with. We are agile and good at adapting and being resilient. And I think that strength is really coming to the fore. I see America on the front foot. I see American corporates on the front foot. May not love everything going on, may love some pieces, but they're starting to act. And I think that means that we will avoid recession. We can expect some slowing growth. Yeah. I think we can expect prices increasing. We can expect a bit of pain, but it's feeling more manageable. And it's not coming in a big tidal wave. It's starting to come through now, but I think we're now going to see some slowing. That one we will.
It's interesting. It wasn't evident from second quarter results for you or even any of your major peers. Credit losses seem really well contained across the industry, and it feels like people are looking for the ghost of this that is going to scare us on the credit side. What do you think? There's something that we're missing, or is it just
I don't think we're going to see it. I mean, for our client base, we're a bit biased because we've got 85% of our clients are investment grade, and they've got big diversified business models, so they can adapt. They can take some of the pain where it comes through, and then drive efficiencies. Where I worry a bit more is the SME and the mid-market companies at the lower end, because they have less resiliency. And so I think that's where we'll probably see some of more of the signs of stress. I would call it a low churn labor market at the moment. We've got less immigration than we had. So you don't have the same influx of new labor looking for jobs. You've got hiring's obviously slowing. You've got attrition way down. So it's a different labor market than the one we've had, but it's not setting off alarm bells either.
You know, you all have had results now that are starting to put you on your front foot. We were talking about this before we started, a little bit about being able to play offense again.
Yes.
As you think about the opportunity to start to deploy capital over the next, let's call it 3-ish years, what are the areas that get you really excited?
Our returns are not where I want them to be. We have a waypoint target for next year. And then I have, you know, how do we then get that up to much higher than that for the longer term? And that's the work that we've got going on at the moment. So if I go of different areas in financing, the private capital space, private asset space for markets is a very lucrative one for us. And I see it as quite a win-win relationship and partnership for us with many of our clients who are in the private capital, private asset space. And broadly, there is a huge need for energy financing, the data centers. It's what, 8 probably $30 to $50 billion each that need to get built around the world. The structuring and helping support with that is an important area. There's a lot of energy needed in the world. So there's a whole range of different areas that need financing. So that's one where we see a lot of opportunity globally, with the US really leading a lot of the way. Then I see other opportunities in areas for us like prime finance. Mm-hmm. We've been building, we've got a strong equities platform that we've been investing in over the last few years. So that's one where we just want to get more volume, leverage our client relationships, and keep putting more of the balances onto our platform. I see in banking, we've been taking share. We've been getting some fantastic talent from the market, marrying with some very strong internal talent. And on the investment banking front, particularly with sponsors, but also technology, healthcare have all been prime growth areas, because every industry has a tech adjacency to it. So that I feel very good about. Services, we'll probably touch on digital assets. I see a pretty exciting opportunity, particularly in the tokenized space, probably a little bit more than stablecoin, but we'll be making sure we've got options on that space as well. Plus, just the growth opportunity from the changes happening in the world in payments, in liquidity, financing is a big opportunity for us in services. And then the credit card space, as we build out the ecosystem around our cards franchise, we've got good growth there. So I don't feel a lack of abundance of growth, both from innovation as well as deepening with clients, and then all the geopolitical and other shifts that are going on.
Well, you hit
it's
on
a good
almost
combo.
You hit on almost every one of your major businesses there.
Yeah.
Maybe if we go back, I'm curious, a little bit of recency bias here, but I had David Rubenstein and Harvey Schwartz from Carlyle on last month, and we talked a lot about private credit and sort of the relationship between the traditional, banks and money center banks and the private credit players. And I'm curious how you think you can benefit from the democratization of private assets, if you will. And maybe as part of that, talk a little bit about any risks you might see as part of the growth.
So one of the benefits is obviously for our wealth franchise. We have very close relationships with a lot of the different players in the wealth space, particularly the alternatives and the private asset, because outside of the US, we've got a very high-end, sophisticated client. And we've got real depth and strength and history in Asia, Middle East. And they are big buyers of the private asset market. And as you get a little lower down, therefore, the democratization becomes very helpful for them in being able to participate. So that for us in wealth, as we build out our investment capabilities around the world and the offering, probably the opportunity I'm most excited about is that playing together. Then on the market side, we've got supporting those in the private asset space is an obvious big opportunity for us in sales and trading. Then let's get to the banking side. So given the capital structure and the capital requirements, even in a, as Scott Bessent puts it, let's take some of the straitjacket off the banks and a more level playing field.
One of the things that's interesting, if you look at the history of the U.S. large banks, they have in the past worked together at times. So the formation, frankly, of the card companies, the rails that we all run on, and that was originally from the banks. There's services like Zelle that have been partnerships amongst the banks.
Yes.
Is there an avenue where it's not each one creating their own, but more of a coalition approach?
Yes, I think there are in a number of areas. I think there is, particularly for the American banks, and I say this with sadness as a former European, that the U.S. banks are the dominant banks globally. And we do the large banks, all of us feel a duty of care to the global financial system. And we are always pushing for areas where there can be utilities that are benefiting our clients to reduce down costs or to provide new services and capabilities that are better done together to serve the industry and to do so safe, sound, not gouging on price, good fraud or cyber or the capabilities behind it. Mm-hmm. Like what are the things that really, you know, enable a client to go to bed at night and someone else is worrying it for them? That's what we often do. And we have a number of different forums. We get together, talk it through, and indeed with some of the regulators around the world.
Right.
So yes, there are forums and we have active dialogues around where it makes sense for us to collaborate as opposed to compete to the death.
Interesting. Well, we'll keep our eyes open for that.
Yeah.
AI is obviously going to affect all of us in many, many ways, all of our companies. As you're thinking about it from an internal perspective, executing an AI plan or strategy across Citi, how are you thinking about that and what's the plan?
So we've got, we basically have three different types of efforts going on. One is where we have a whole set of tools that is available for the whole firm. I have 180,000 employees at the moment who have access to what we call Stylus, which then is based off one of the big large language models, and it will do summarization. So for example, credit memos, one of the great hated things within a corporate bank, writing the credit memo. Yeah. We'll get the first draft written by our AI tool. Our teams will go through, they'll fix things, they'll look at it, they'll make sure, they'll make adjustments, and then AI will come in at the end and will then check that we have indeed complied with all of the policies, legal requirements, other pieces like that, and it's submitted. That is taking hours off. We had our strategy offsite for our board last week. The first draft of the accompanying memos to the documentation was written by AI. We had to go in, fix a number of various bits and pieces, and then they were submitted. These are just little examples of the bottom of helping people do their job better and more easily. We got policy checking, do you complying with policy? We have an HR policy tool. So that is in our AI toolkit. That is also enabling people to come up with use case ideas. That goes into the second bucket where we have use cases that we're then driving firm-wide or in individual businesses or functions. If you have 1,000 flowers blooming, you're likely to have 1,000 flowers dead. Mm-hmm. So you choose which are the ones that you go, okay, these are the ones that are worth, from a shareholder perspective, mm-hmm. pursuing, or regulatory or client, and then you drive them at scale through the firm. So those are the top-down use cases, some of which may have bubbled up from the bottom-up ideas of our teams. And then across all of that, you've got all the coding that is getting written off the new tools.
Yeah, that's happening quickly across every company.
Then we come to agentic.
Yeah.
And we've been using Devon on agentic. It's, I think, will be game-changing. Mm-hmm. What it is enabling us to do in coding, because it then acts upon, it's not only giving you information, but it then acts. That is, I can see how that's really going to happen fast and change mm-hmm. a lot of banking. Yeah. And that's the area that I think we all of us feel like we're just scratching the surface of what that can do and will do. Really changing workflows, models, and how work gets done. It's exciting and it's scary.
Yeah, it ties back, I think, a little bit to the beginning of our conversation. We were talking about the labor market and sort of the stagnation that's going on there. And it almost feels like there's a little bit of a hesitancy for people to leave the workforce, wondering like, will I be able to re-engage because worrying a little bit about automation and what's going to happen to their existing roles.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit of people in your seat and others hesitating to go make a bunch of new hires because, well, maybe if I just hold off on filling that position, I'll figure out a way to do it with AI or something else.
It's already started. Yeah. But at the same time, there are new things that are coming through. So there are new roles, there are new opportunities. And I have to say, I think one of the benefits of being a larger institution is for our talent, we can offer them some of the flexibility. I think I was down at our Dallas site recently. I first started getting there 15 years ago. It was our default servicing center. There's probably 10,000 people there. Mm-hmm. it morphed into being the credit card processing when the default servicing changed. Then it became our commercial bank had operations there. It then became even heavier as a tech center. Then it became cyber, other things coming in. And it's the joy of being a larger institution. People adapt.
Yeah.
And so our talent and our people can have multiple careers within the Citi family. Mm-hmm. So I think it will be very disruptive for a lot of jobs in the next 3 years. But I also think there's going to be new ones that are going to be coming through. So the talent doesn't need to be as afraid in right. the larger organizations where we'll train and get them redeployed, as opposed to others where you won't have the same advantages, because right. it is going to be very disruptive. And we've all got to think about, we've got to reimagine
everything
that we do is changing.
Yes. And I think it's amazing to me, you know, having been newer in the workforce through the .com rise, this one feels different to me
yes.
in a much more
yeah.
Tangible way. Maybe it was just the ignorance of youth at the time, and I thought I was, you know, indestructible or whatever, but this one feels much different to me.
I think it's happening faster is the other piece. I
right.
think that's where the worry sits for the labor market, yeah. is it's
the
happening
pace.
Faster.
Yeah,
yes.
That's very fair.
Yeah.
Very fair. Let's pivot a little bit to leadership and sort of your experiences there.
The scars on the arm. Yes.
They're for sure. I'm sure we all have them. What's the thing about being a CEO that people who are not in the role would have a hard time appreciating?
The amount of stakeholder management on your day. I had underappreciated how much of your time is spent doing that. Mm-hmm. But we often talk of the board. Well, there's no such thing as the board. It is, you know, 12, 13 highly talented individuals all with opinions, but there's not one.
Right.
So and getting the most from your board requires a lot of one-on-one interactions and other pieces as well to help you. Obviously, there's media. If I go down to Washington, it might be to see the White House. It might be to see Treasury. It could be down to go and see the global financial sort of infrastructure
right.
like World Bank, IMF, et cetera. It could be going to see the different regulators we have. It could be going to the Hill to see. There's a lot down in Washington alone. And if you're global, you have the same in London, you have the same in Frankfurt,
right.
you've got Emmett, you've got Singapore, you've got Hong Kong,
time.
And they
yeah.
all need a relationship
yeah.
with you.
Yeah.
You obviously have the media, you've got your investors, you've got your clients, you've got your employees, different activist groups, things like that. So a huge amount of the time is for the CEO to be in front of that group. And then the other piece is there's a lot of decisions that come down to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the direction, you know, if you're going to go a particular piece, it is down to the CEO. And you can get input from others, but everyone else tends to have, you know, not be as objective. When you're the CEO, you're very objective around the pieces. You're really thinking the whole institution. You don't have a vested interest to a particular business or a particular group. You see the whole picture, and it's one of the great joys of the job, because you're very empowered. But you realize, yeah, a lot of it is up to you.
You mentioned, you know, using the board to help get the
yeah.
most out of them. Who else do you use for guidance or to help, you know, think about hard decisions, or frankly, just to vent when something's like frustrating you?
Yeah, I have a wonderful husband who has come from the banking industry
uh-huh.
and retired now, but that is definitely helpful for some of the venting.
Yeah.
You know, internally, there's different people have got different skill sets for different big issues that come up. So you'll pull different groups of folk together. You know, our general counsel and HR head are often part of that, or other times it might be more of our control head, risk head, others for things, geopolitics coming up, our head of international war in Russia
yeah.
and Ukraine. You know, it's a different group. So you pull on that expertise. Externally, I have other CEOs are always very helpful because some of the issues, how have you dealt with X? How have you dealt with Y? So a Julie Sweet at Accenture, an Andy Jassy, or a Satya, how are you dealing with AI? You know, Greg Case is someone who I've known for many years out at Aon. You know, so there's a group of people whose judgment you find helpful, and the phone a friend.
Right.
His fellow CEOs, sometimes within the same industry.
Right.
And then you'll have other people who are just advisors you've known for you, for a long time, who you trust to be completely discreet. And you need the truth tellers who don't have an agenda.
It's so funny you mentioned that. I was just in the office of a colleague the other day, and I said to him, like, you've always been my truth teller, somebody I've worked with since the beginning of my time at T. Rowe. It's really important to have those people who are just...
And that's
it doesn't matter. They'll tell you.
That's the advice as well that one of our board members, Peter Henry, used to run the Stern Business School. He's over at Stanford again now. And he'd always said this big ears and thick skin and that listening. And he said, look, every year you're the CEO, you'll have fewer and fewer people wanting to tell you what's actually happening and what's really going on. And you need to build different ears and listening skills. And he's right.
One of the things that you all have embarked on as part of the strategic realignment of the company and really, you know, focusing in is changing the incentives. So I think you've driven more towards a return on capital model for your people. Implementing something like that can be really challenging and can have, you know, adverse selection risks where, you know, you have to worry about losing your best people if they don't like the metrics that they're assigned. How did you go about implementing that change?
Well, when you were trading where we were trading and you had the return levels we had, there was, you know, it was the why was blindingly obvious. So it didn't need, you know, the case as to why was pretty obvious to everyone. If you're then putting in more of a culture of accountability and of excellence and an expectation for people, they should be winning all the time, and there is an intolerance of losing. You keep the best people, so you don't have an adverse selection issue. You have an adverse selection if you have a culture of mediocrity. If you have a culture of excellence and accountability, that's something the best people want to be in. So actually, I found it was a flip. The other thing that was a help on the reorg, I do believe in transparency. And so we gave a lot of transparency as the performance of our five core businesses. And it's quite radical transparency for the street versus what used to be when we had almost more of a holding company mindset at the top rather than an operator model. And for those businesses, it's those business leaders, it's their reputation. Whether they're standing, everyone can see exactly how they're performing. And that level of transparency, I think, is also very valuable. So it's not just the returns as incentive, but real transparency and being willing to, you know, put yourself on the hook on that, and then making sure your team feel that too. That's been an important part of the mix. There's nowhere to hide.
What's the best advice you've been given since you got into this role?
It definitely was the big ears and thick skin one, because there's a lot of resiliency. You have to. It's also weird because a lot of the naysayers are out of date with where you are. Now, they may still be naysayers in X time, but right now, I'm doing a lot of work on 27, 28. And what are the actions we've got to do in the second half of this year and 26 to get, for thinking about that, because you're setting it up now for the longer term. And the work we're doing at the same time of feeling the pressure of delivering 25 and a lot of pressure on delivering 26. But what the street or what media or other things, they're reacting to stuff that are decisions we made a year ago. And so you just have to, or they may not see all the pieces as they're coming through. And there were a lot of naysayers around, would city change? Would it be a new city? It's been a lot of work, and we tried to be very clear, it'd be multi-year. This wasn't, we weren't going to take the easy path. This wasn't about makeup.
Right.
This was makeover, not makeup.
It's a lot harder to do,
and it takes longer, and it's not as transparent to everyone.
Right.
Immediately, the divestitures were. So you just have to make sure you stick to the plan. Yeah. Like, we have a vision, we have a strategy, we put a lot of work into it. Get it done, and don't get deviated by noise. Focus on the signal.
Yeah. What advice do you give to younger people, especially as they're kind of starting out in their career, and ask you, you know, like, oh, how did you do it? What should I do?
Look, I think the world's changed for younger folk than the decades ago when I first started. And I look at it with my own kids. I've got a son over at Morgan Stanley, and I've got another over in the tech world. And I think the piece I think of them starting out, they're going to have multiple careers in their life. Mm-hmm. They're going to have jobs that will no longer be jobs in a number of years' time.
Right.
And so how to build the resiliency, how to build, what are the skill sets that are going to be important ones that give you an ability to reinvent yourself?
Mm-hmm.
What are more of the, you no longer need to know the answer. You just need to know what question to ask in an AI world and ask it well.
Yep.
That's very different from the cramming I had to learn how to do.
Oh,
and you were probably the same right?
Yeah, who could jam the most in there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just not going to need to know the answer. You're going to need judgment. You're going to need a whole range of other things. So it's actually for the young kids now, dream is my advice.
Interesting.
Build resiliency, but dream. Don't feel you've got to be pigeonholed into things, because there's so many pressures on the kids coming out of college.
Yeah. Well, just the recruiting process. We were talking about this.
There's no way I would make it today.
Yeah.
There's no way. My first job was investment banking and M&A. I can't imagine I would have got that. But on the other hand, you look at the youth today, they're so talented, they're so creative, much more entrepreneurial, so much more at their fingertips. So how do you help them feel a bit like the banks out of the straitjacket and dream?
That's great. just to wrap up, I'm curious, you know, what do you do to, when you try to get away from work and try to decompress or unwind, any hobbies that you're passionate about?
I do love traveling.
Uh-huh.
So for me, one of the great joys of the world, because it's a job that's often 7 days a week by the nature of it.
Sure.
And it's a privilege to have this job. Like, it is utterly extraordinary what you learn, what you get to see, problems you try and solve. So you get a lot of energy from that.
Mm-hmm.
But you are always on. I love being able to go when I'm in different parts of the world, if you get the Saturday off, go and explore a village somewhere, go for a hike in the mountains, go and, go and make the most of being somewhere. My husband and I are going to be in, we end up being in all sorts of different places in Asia.
Uh-huh.
And we always have the zombie day, which is when you get there jet lagged on Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon. You're like, oh my God, I've got to adjust to the jet lag and be on Monday morning. And so we're always going to try and find, a cute little restaurant that's not some fancy schmancy, but somewhere you can have an amazing sushi meal or a teppanyaki in Japan, or just go and explore the places and enjoy seeing the cultures. That's really wonderful.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's
fun.
That's
great. Well, Jane, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure to spend time with you. Super interesting, incredibly insightful, and love to see City as a disruptor. Keep at it.
Will do. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Again, I'm Eric Vial. Thank you for listening to The Angle. We look forward to your company on future episodes. You can find more information about this and other topics on our website. Please rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Angle, better questions, better insights, only from T. Rowe Price.
This podcast episode was recorded in August of 2025 and is for general information and educational purposes only. Outside of the United States, it is for investment professional use only. It is not intended to be used by persons in jurisdictions which prohibit or restrict distribution of the material herein. The podcast does not give advice or recommendation of any nature or constitute an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any security in any jurisdiction. Prospective investors should seek independent legal, financial, and tax advice before making any investment decision. Past performance is not a guarantee or a reliable indicator of future results. All investments are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Discussions relating to specific securities are informational only and are not recommendations and may or may not have been held in any T. Rowe Price portfolio. There should be no assumption that the securities were or will be profitable. T. Rowe Price is not affiliated with or a subsidiary of any company discussed. The views contained herein are those of the speakers as of the date of the recording and are subject to change without notice. The views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price associates and or affiliates. Information is from sources deemed reliable but not guaranteed. Please visit https://www.troweprice.com/en/uk/insights/the-long-view-city for full global issuer disclosures. This podcast is copyright by T. Rowe Price 2025.